Thank you for joining me for today's 6th CEU home study, which is pre-approved for licensed professional counselors, licensed professional clinical counselors, and supervising counselors in Ohio by the State of Ohio Counselor, Social Worker, and Marriage and Family Therapist Board. I'll be your presenter for today's seminar. My name's Michelle Olewicz, and today we're going to talk about the foundations of positive parenting. A lot of times we may have to have a clientele where the parents may drop off the kids and just want them fixed or want us to work on them. But as we all know, a lot of times we're talking about system dynamics. We're talking about family of origin issues. We're talking about working with the child. We're talking about working with the setting, the context, and also with the community. So there's a lot of different dynamics we're going to talk about today, but we're going to try and come at it from a strengths-based perspective, both focusing on the individual child as well as giving support to the parents and the system. So what are some of the things that parents and families tend to come to us about in clinical counseling? The top 10 family stresses that have been stated in the literature are the following. Things like economics, finances, and budgeting, children's behavior, discipline, or fighting among family members or siblings, not enough time for the couple, feeling like there's that lack of balance, lack of shared responsibilities in the family, so one or more of the family members feeling overburdened, difficulty in communication with the children. And we'll talk a lot today about how to individualize treatment, individualize the things that they can do in their home, in the schools, and in the community to each given child based on their age, based on their developmental level, based on the antecedents, the consequences, what works and what doesn't work. Another one of the top 10 family stresses is people feeling like there's just not enough me time. The schedules are packed out. They're so busy. There's not time for self-care. And that can spill over if anybody in that family system doesn't have that balance into their interactions with one another. Also, family members oftentimes feel guilt for not getting, quote, enough done. Spousal relationship and communication in the marriage relationship, and including things like intimacy and sex, having not enough family playtime. I remember one couple where the wife came in crying and said that things were going so badly because she said we're not together anymore. And it's real important as we work with families to look at their operational definitions of things. For her, together meant all of us in the family, all three or four kids, mom and dad, are doing the same activities at the exact same time. And the husband looked so surprised when she said that. He's like, what do you mean we're not together? That's all we ever do is spend time together. Which, of course, further made her feel hurt. So how they defined together was different. To him, the idea was, you know, they're in the same space at the same time, and even if they're not doing the same exact activity, they're, quote, together. For her, it was a matter of we're eating meals at the same time at the table, we're directly interacting with each other, and after the meal, we're doing the same single activity. The husband's idea of together, he said, well, I'm in the house when you're there. I'm not running around somewhere else. I come home from work. The kids are home instead of running this way and that. Yeah, one of them likes to watch certain TV shows, and the other one likes other shows. A third one likes certain video games or computer time, and I like to be on my laptop. And the wife just felt that for togetherness, and how she defined it was, we're all doing the same thing at the same time. And then finally, just an overscheduled family calendar is something that you hear more of. One of the things that I would encourage you to talk with the parents, children, and families you work with about is get an idea of what constitutes stress for them, what keeps them and their family stressed out, as well as when things have gone better, what's been more calming. I always like to use the idea of what I call a camera check. If there was an imaginary video camera there, what would it see going on when things aren't going as well? Is everybody running, doing their own thing? Is the time schedule too packed? Are people yelling and not really hearing each other out? Versus what happens in the times when things have gone better. Are we actually spending time together? Are we prioritizing our schedule better? So as we enter this seminar, I want to be clear about some factors that the literature says are consistent in terms of characteristics of what the literature would define as healthy families. And these are things you might want to keep in mind as we do cognitive behavioral therapy with families about their belief systems, because a lot of where we find struggles is in some belief systems and behaviors that aren't healthy. So one of the characteristics of healthy families is that they view stress as a normal part of family life. Where we see a problem, on the other hand, is the families who act surprised when something doesn't go just as planned. They act surprised. They feel like things should always be going perfectly calm and happy, and nothing should ever go wrong. There should never be a bump in the road. They don't realize that stress actually is what can build resilience. Healthy families have a format of communication. They share feelings as well as words. And when you have a family system where one or more people may struggle with this, oftentimes the foundations that we need to work with these families on might start with something like those I messages. Statements like, I feel such and such when such and such situations happen. This is what I would like to happen instead. Or in the past, I felt better, happier. I felt we were more as a team and we pulled together when such and such happened. Healthy families have a plan and an approach for when there is conflict. And they have creative coping skills. What I tell families when I work with them is the time to deal with conflict is not right when you're in the middle of it. The time to deal with conflict and approach it is to have a plan ahead of time. What are we going to do? So we fool ourselves when we think that we're not going to have conflict. We're not going to have problems. Instead, we can look at, yeah, life's going to happen to every family. We're going to have differences of opinion. We're going to have different approaches. And let's talk ahead of time about how we're going to do that. Are we going to go to different spaces? Are we going to set an amount of time before we come back and discuss? What's the approach going to be? Healthy families also have strong support systems. They've discussed and they know ahead of time who's okay to go to. When I say strong support system, I'm not just talking about someone they can go to complain about things. I'm talking about agreed upon supports that will hold people accountable to healthy behaviors, that they will be straightforward with, that they can hear the truth about, that they can learn communication and other skills. Healthy families are flexible. Healthy families do talk about issues. They don't sweep them under the rugs, whether it be money, whether it be communication skills, whether it be how they're going to solve conflicts. So with communication of healthy family, they talk less and listen more. They're as focused on taking others' perspectives, on developing empathy, on perspective taking, than they are just being heard. There's a vulnerability. Just like with any healthy, quality relationship, there's an ability for people to really admit their weaknesses and their problems. In healthy families, They take into account verbal and nonverbal behavior. So they try to put behaviors in context. So maybe someone's having a bad behavior. Maybe they might be saying some snappy words, but you realize that their heart is that they love you and they're just stressed because too much is going on and the plan of action isn't working. Healthy families realize that being in relationship is more important than behavior being perfect, precise, and exact. In healthy families, they have a certain approach to children. Children are respected for their uniqueness. It's not just that approach of children are seen and not heard. It's the approach of there is room for a child to have awe and wonder and explore and feel acknowledged and heard. Children feel loved. They're attended to. It's not just about what is said, but appropriate behavior is demonstrated. This is what I'd really like to highlight, and you'll hear me talk a lot about in today's seminar, because I have heard from child after child, whether they're 5-year-old or whether they're 18 years old, that one of the biggest struggles they have is when a rule is being stated verbally in the home but is not modeled or reinforced by the parents. When there's this idea that parents can do whatever they please and can violate the very rules that they're trying to give the children. I've had teens, for example, that have said, oh, my mom goes out to the club looking like a hoochie and I worry about what's going to happen to her, but then she yells at me about how I'm dressed. Or my parents cuss and scream and yell and hurt each other, but we're supposed to be calm. So having that consistency in what the rules are and the actual behaviors with the parents as well. Rules need to be flexible enough to accommodate what exceptions there may be. One of the other things we see in another category of these characteristics of healthy families is that healthy families limit the amount of work that they take home. They make sure that even if they have a busy job, that there is a compartment in their life that is for work, and there's also a compartment in life for family. They try not to work excessively above 40 hours a week. They allow for time with friends. They allow for spiritual development, whether that's formal church services, whether that's things to build their identity and their sense of community. They balance couple and personal time. This next one, I really like the way it's worded. Dignity and respect as a person is valued over power or status as an individual. Let me say that one more time to make sure you got that. Dignity and respect as a person is valued over power and status as an individual. One of the things I'm going to be highlighting quite a bit today is the idea that when there's a sense of discipline, correction, or consequence, it needs to be in a setting of love, in a setting where there is relationship as a foundation. Otherwise, it won't work. Healthy families cooperate. There's a sense of team. Responsibilities are shared. There's a sense of hope and optimism that even when there's stress, we can figure out a way to make it. One of the terms you hear a lot is this idea of family meetings. There's a time that is set in a healthy family where they will interact with each other, and people know when that is. Even though nowadays we're torn every which way, it's really important for families to know, even if it's once a week, that we have an hour where we kind of check in with each other. If this is not made as part of the routine, how in the world are the kids or the parents going to know how to do that? I've had a lot of success even when we've had a young child or a toddler, a preteen, and a teen involved, where the kids are actively involved in setting up and determining things about the family meetings. We use a solution-focused approach to look at what has gone well. That can be very affirming. What qualities, what ways have we built up the family? What is the agenda of the family meeting? It doesn't have to be an all serious kind of get together. It doesn't have to just be about problem solving. It could be about sharing what happened in the week. It could be about showing a talent. I remember in one family, I had one of the younger kids who loved art would share a coloring picture. Another one would talk about some, you know, social concerns that they had about friends or about the family. Then, yes, the family meetings can be a place of problem solving. And you could talk about things like, what is our schedule? What are our meals? What are our activities? What I found helpful, whether it's with couples or whether it's with families, is sometimes using an object during these times of family meetings to delineate who has the floor. Whose turn is it? So it could be a pen or pencil. It could be a stuffed animal. I actually know a colleague of ours who literally uses a piece of carpet. And he talks about who has the floor. Whoever is talking at that time then would be the person that all eyes should be on. That also helps to reinforce the concepts of empathy, paraphrasing, and taking that person's perspective. With the idea that right now, when so-and-so is talking, we're just trying to understand where he or she is coming from. So what are some of the areas that parents come to us about that they have problems with? Well, the key problem areas tend to be either too little control or too much control. Some parents just basically are more permissive. They excuse any behavior as this is just a kid. The parent ends up frustrated because they feel overwhelmed. They're doing not only their job as a parent, but the child's job. This might be a parent who tells little Johnny to go ahead and clean up the room after he's put his toys everywhere, but then says, fine, you know, we got to get this house clean, and ends up picking it up for him. This person, when they do follow through as a parent, they do it oftentimes with using bribery, politeness, or instead of making statements like, Johnny, I need you to pick up your toys before you go to bed. I will be giving you a warning, and then we will stop playing, and it will be time for you to pick up the toys. If you do not pick up the toys, there will not be your new game tomorrow. We will not get to do such and such tomorrow. So it's phrased as a statement. We see parents who tend to be more permissive and have this issue of too little control, oftentimes phrasing things in terms of questions. Things like, well, Johnny, would you please pick up the toys? Johnny, would you like to pick up the toys so we could have a good day tomorrow? And keep in mind, as adults, if you phrase something as a question to another adult, it's not like they're going to be thrilled to pick up their stuff either. So it's important to phrase things as a statement with the conditions of what reinforcement will happen or what consequence will happen. Oftentimes, one of the problems you see with parents with too little control is they give conflicting messages. This is a parent who says, we're going to the grocery store to get our groceries, no toys, no candy, no stuff in the checkout aisle. And then when the child starts throwing a fit, they say, okay, fine, we'll just get one candy bar. Okay, just a small toy. So that child learns that if I whine enough, if I complain enough, parents will give in. You find battles of will. This parent, who has too little control, can actually be afraid of the child. They don't want to hurt them. And what happens is, in the long run, we see kids that are unruly, that are rude, insensitive, spoiled, and really don't know how to deal with the real world. In the real world, you got to show up to work on time. I've seen young adults, 18 to 25, who were shocked because they got written up on their job because they were just surprised that, oh, well, they didn't show up to work, and why was that such a big deal? Or the clothes they wore to work, or the mannerisms that they used. So we talked about too little control. Another type of problem we often hear that comes into our office is too much control. This would be the parent who's overly strict. This is a parent who looks at, my child's a reflection of me. They over-identify with their role as a parent. They're perfectionistic to the point they smother the child. They want things done right. There's not room for mercy. There's not room for forgiveness. There's not a sense of allowing the child to have any awe or wonder or figure things out. Parents are overbearing. They're inflexible. And they have difficulty coping with real life situations. So one of the questions that I've asked parents when they've come in regarding specifically parenting issue is I've wanted to make clear what their goal is. Is their goal one of just stopping immediate behavior problems because they feel annoyed as a parent? You know, this is a parent who would say things like, I just want my child to shut up. They're too loud. I just want them to obey, and I don't care what it takes. Oh, I just want them to do the chores. I don't care if they like it or not. Or is their goal teaching long-term lessons? Lessons like respect, lessons like perspective taking. So I really clarify this with a parent because when I was first working in the counseling field, I put so much effort in. I put the effort sometimes, frankly, that the parents should have put in. And then I realized, you know, kids would start telling me, oh, my grandmother, who's my guardian, you know, if I complain enough, she'll just buy me the new shoes I want. One child said, oh, well, she's diabetic. She's tired all the time. She can't keep up with whatever. So then I just say these certain things and I know that she'll give in. So I want to make sure, are they willing to deal with shorter term increase, oftentimes in frustration, when they're starting to set boundaries and learning healthy parenting, or they just want a quick answer, or the child to be calm. So there's several different approaches we're going to look at today. We're going to look at individual psychotherapy, different techniques for counseling the child one-on-one. There's a number of different skill sets or social skills training that we can do with the child. We can also look at the family system. The idea is that ultimately there can be maladaptive family home interactions. There can be family of origin issues that promote aggression, that suppress prosocial behavior, things like temper tantrums, lack of following parental rules, and bad attitudes might be reinforced by parents. Did you ever think about that? Now, a lot of times when we have these behavior disordered kids, the parents are reinforcing certain things. And that's what we're going to look at when we look at things about antecedents, behavior, and consequence. We look at other types of therapy, like structural family therapy, where the family is viewed as either being organized, functioning, or disorganized and malfunctioning. So the therapist in therapy would counsel the entire family. The identified client wouldn't be just the troubled child. It wouldn't be the parents who don't have the skills. It would be reorganizing the system. Then we have something called multi-target ecological treatment, MET. The idea being there's so many different causes and influences that simultaneously pull on a child or a family. These all combine to contribute to behavioral issues in children, parenting, and family. And so really a therapy approach shouldn't just be one therapy, but multiple therapies to affect this. Then we have a method I'll talk in depth about later, the IRS method, looking at parenting assumptions and whether they're correct or incorrect. Because sometimes parents can go in with certain assumptions, and that can make things very challenging. And those assumptions may not always be correct. We will also look at how sometimes pairing a professional, like a licensed therapist, with a parent team who has successfully learned parenting and doing parenting groups can help. There are certain types of groups, especially in lower socioeconomic groups, that tend to do better with this parental, paraprofessional, and professional team approach. Because this way, it gives validation to the world of the parents that are in the group. Instead of a behavioral parenting group where the therapist is the expert coming at the parents, telling them what they should do, this team approach helps the parents feel like, okay, someone's actually hearing what influences us and our families, our community, our culture, the kids we're working with. We will also talk today about how to use strengths-based and solution-focused therapy. Oftentimes when people come into us, it's because there is a presenting problem. But what we're doing with strengths-based solution-focused therapy is reframing deficits as strengths. When we're talking about modifying behavior, we're going to be talking about every behavior is governed by what happens immediately before, which is called an antecedent, and what happens in reaction to it, a consequence. So we're going to be looking at the context in which things happen. Behaviors are centered around conditions, where they happen. For example, you might have a child who acts up at school but not at home, or who acts up out in public, or with certain relatives but not others. You might have a child who finds it easier to sit still when they have something in their hand to play with. But if they just have to sit still and face a teacher and don't have anything to hold on to, that might be challenging. Behavior modification and rule setting that we'll be talking about is for a specific person. It talks about a behavior that's identified. It's measurable. We can see it. We can use that idea that I mentioned earlier of the camera check. What would the imaginary video see? Would it see the child sitting on his or her bottom, looking forward and not fidgeting? For what length of time? Behaviors can be modifiable, and it has to be something that's achievable. I've had situations, for example, where parents may have lofty goals for their kids. They might even have goals that sound good, but then when I ask them about what the child's able to do or achieve, I realize that it's basically a near impossible goal. I had one family where the parents wanted their child to sit still at dinner time. And I said, okay, how often do you want that to happen? They said, well, at least during the week, Monday through Friday. On the weekend, we're a little more flexible about ordering pizza, ordering out, sitting in the living room, watching TV at the same time. You know, but during the week when it's family time, or if we have guests over, we like to sit at the table. And I'd like my child to sit on their bottom, focus, look forward, and eat their food. And not be fidgeting, not climbing on the chairs, not moving around the room. So when we talk in depth about that, I say, so how often has it happened? Out of 5 days in an average week, how often? Does it happen even one day? Well, no, I can't even get them to be still during a whole meal. Okay, how many minutes do you think you can get them to be still? Oh, I don't even know, maybe two? So you see, they're wanting to jump from 2 minutes, one meal a day, and this is a half-hour meal, to 5 days a week, all half-hour meals, all the time, sitting on their bottom, not fidgeting or fussing. There's a lot of things that need to be learned that we'll need to work with them on. It's not realistic. So we will go back to, a lot of times, the goal setting to see if what the goals are even realistic or rational, or if it needs to be further broken down, if skills need to be taught. There's a lot of times misunderstanding about that. We also need to do some education sometimes with parents about the different types of reasons why kids do what they do. It could be attention seeking. And one way they could notice that is what happens when the environment changes. If the parent's attention is on them or is off them, what happens then? Do they pipe up louder? Do they whine? Behaviors also can be for escape or for avoidance. They can be for control. They can be for self-expression. So before we get to consequences or discipline for inappropriate behavior, one of the things I want to highlight is the skills of building positive, pro-social, or appropriate on-task behavior. It's important to do this because all too often when we develop rules for kids, we talk about what we don't want them to do. I'll ask so many kids and parents to come in with a list of what they think the rules or expectations are, and they'll say stuff like, keep your, don't hit people, don't kick, don't cuss, don't be too angry. And I'm like, well, what should you be doing instead? Instead of hitting and kicking and punching, where should your hands and feet be? Well, I don't know. I just know when I get mad, I can't sit still. So it's very important to make sure we have a solid foundation about what the rules and expectations are, that there's no doubt that the child and the parents have the skills to affirm the positive pro-social behavior. And I've even phrased this before about, I want to give you every chance to be rewarded. I want to be able to back you up and say to your parent that, you know, look at what this child's doing, and to affirm it. But I can't do that unless we're all clear about what the rules and expectations are. So, first of all, we look at things like attending. Well, one of the phrases we hear in society today is how much these kids are attention-seeking. And it's very hard when parents have so many multiple roles, when kids have so many multiple roles. So when I'm talking about attending, I'm talking about a parent giving full attention, one-on-one time to that kid. People ask, how much time does this have to happen? It doesn't necessarily have to be hours and hours or days and days. If it's 15 or 20 minutes where that child knows, oh, you're looking at what they're doing, you're focusing, you're noticing differences from what they did to what they're not doing or what changed, then they're like, huh, it gives a message that mom and dad care, they're noticing. So we're giving full attention. Then the next step would be we'd use a news reporter style to name what they're doing. Oh, Mary, I see you got out your crayons and you got out one of your favorite coloring books about your dolls. Oh, you're laying those across the floor and you're lining up the crayons. Seems like you're getting ready to really do some serious coloring. Huh, I saw that you picked a red crayon and you seem to be coloring that doll's dress very fast. Back and forth. Wow, look at all that red back and forth. You're getting her sleeves, you're getting her dress. And now I see you're looking at the crayons there too. While you're holding the red, seems like you're looking for another one too. So you're just naming, you're just describing. You're noticing changes and differences in behavior. Now some of the questions that come up, well, what happens when she gets mad and throws a crayon? What happens when she has a fit because she colored out of the line? So at this point, we just want to affirm and notice what she's trying to do. As long as no one's getting hurt, we don't have to dive in about those things. So the idea, again, is not that it's necessarily a big quantity of time, but that we're consistent and the child knows, you know, the 15 minutes at the end of every day, or so many times a week, I have one-on-one time with my parent. So let's look at a few case scenarios and see how we would do this. John is fascinated by different types of toy cars. He has quite a collection of cars. One day during Mommy and John time, she notices John's playing with the cars. He races the fast sports cars. Then he puts other cars in a line and as some of them crash. He brings the emergency vehicles over and the road crew. When the phone rings, Mom stops to answer the phone, and Johnny throws his cars around the room. So let's think about this here. It would be easy for mom to be ranting and raving about, Johnny, you just messed up. You threw the cards. Now the room's awful. Look at this. Gosh, I couldn't even talk on the phone for a little while. Why are you doing that? But again, look at the reasons children might be doing behaviors. So if I'm just attending, that's my only job, interacting with this child, I might say comments like, wow, I see that you got the sports cars in a group there. You got a fast red car, and then you have that yellow one that's really low, and you're rarely revving it up. The orange one's near it. Man, and then you got these other kind of cars that also kind of look alike, but they're in a different line. Oh, something changed. Now we got some emergency vehicles coming over. I think it's important for the child to know that this time with the toy cars is his time. If there's a possibility that an important phone call might come in during that time, it may be important to signal your child. If at all possible, it's really important to not allow for those interruptions. Let's look at another example here. Mary Ellen enjoys coloring. She especially loves to make pictures of flowers. In today's drawing, she chooses pink and purple shades for the petals of the flowers. When drawing petals, she cannot find the, quote, regular green. There's only a yellowish green or a deep forest green. She comments, this isn't right. The flowers aren't supposed to look like this. She starts ripping up her paper and crumbling it because she thinks it did not turn out the way she planned with the green color. So keep in mind, kids are going to have their frustrations. They're going to act out. But at this point, we're just attending. Wow, yeah, I see that you are making your flowers again. Ooh, those are your favorite colors. You picked that pink and purple again. Oh, wow. And I see that you got a lot of pink, a lot of colorful pink, a light pink, a darker pink, and then purple. And I see now that you're trying to draw the grass. Looks like you're looking for just the right color. You're really looking around. So you put the pink and purple down, and it looks like you're ready for the grass, but something's going on. And she may throw the crayon, and she might say, oh, this is dumb, I can't find the right... Say, it's hard when the green isn't the green you wanted. So that's not the green for the grass, huh? So instead of correcting her about ripping the paper, instead of disciplining her, instead of becoming frustrated with her, naming her frustration, maybe putting a feeling word on it can be very helpful. You really feel sad because you were ready to make the prettiest flowers ever, and this is the yucky green. You didn't feel like this was a green that you usually use, and you're not sure what to do. At this point, again, we're not intervening. We're not trying to solve the problem for them. Unless they come to you and ask you, Mom, can you help me find this other green that I use? On the other hand, we're just going to relate to where they're at with the coloring or the activity they're doing. Let's look at this next one here. Lou likes watching his dad mow the lawn and work in the yard. He uses his toy lawnmower and plastic tools in the yard, too. He walks in a line up and down the grass to mow evenly, just like his dad. Up and down, up and down. That is until the wheel gets stuck on a branch and some leaves. He can't push the plastic mower in a nice line like dad anymore. This is stupid. It's messing up everything now, Lou screams. So I might say, if I was a dad, Lou, seems like you're trying to get the lines just right. Oh, I got this big lawnmower here, and you got yours. We're both going to get the job done. Wow, up and down, back and forth. You're going in those rows. Oh, mowing can, and I might even say something that's apparent. Mowing can be tough when these leaves and branches are in the way. I got this heavy mower, and it can be really tough with a little mower like that. That's hard sometimes to deal with. Let's look at this last scenario here in terms of the case scenarios about affirming and attending. Kara is getting dressed to hang out this evening with her teen friends. She had picked out the perfect outfit, but when she put it on, just before heading out the door, the jacket ripped. She definitely can't wear it now. The only other jacket at all like it is in her closet and is 2 years old. Her friends and the other teens would certainly see it's not the current style. She stomps around pulling frantically at the clothes in the closet. So the reason I included this scenario is because you can modify this attending news reporter approach to work with a teen. I'm not talking about mimicking them or making fun of it or, gosh, you know, you're just trying to always pick the perfect outfit, aren't you? Took a lot of time, didn't it? I would say something like, oh, I know it's so important to get out with your friends or whatever. Seems like what you initially picked's not working out. You're really having to think of what you're going to do at this point. And then, you know, just noticing that the parent's paying attention and that the parent's seeming as concerned about what's concerning to them can make a difference. I'd encourage you to pause this recording and practice. If you can find a partner that you can practice attending, maybe take out a sheet of paper, draw a drawing. It could be a stick figure. It doesn't have to be real elaborate. Or do an activity or talk about something and see if your partner and you can just name, just news reporter style, this is what happened. You were doing this, now you're doing that. You can talk about the rate at which they're doing things, how they're doing them, any body language you notice that is different. Just noticing changes. The message we want to give is you're important to me, and I'm observing what you're going through and what you're doing. Some of the frustrations I know when we're just at this point in teaching these skills is sometimes you do have kids that will have inappropriate behavior during attending time. And parents are like, well, what do I do? Obviously, if there's safety concerns, you do have to intervene. You'll have to stop things. If there's a danger to that child, if someone else may get hurt, sometimes kids might even comment and say, well, you're acting kind of weird and kind of different. And I tell the parent, that's great. That's actually a really good thing. If they notice that you're acting different, then you could say, you know, I thought I was doing things pretty good, but I realize that maybe I'm not paying attention to you or noticing things as much as I could. And I wanted to make sure you really knew that I did care about the stuff that's important to you and did notice. So the things we want to make sure we're doing in terms of really empathizing is giving the child our full attention, using a word, a feelings word, to name what they might be going through. So if someone's frustrated, if they're sad, if they thought things were going to go one way and they ended up another way, name the child's feeling. Try to meet the child where he or she is at. So don't take them right away to the problem solving. I think one of the errors I see with parents most often is they want to solve the problem for the child. They want to give them a solution. They want to tell them what to do. And that's not where the child's at. When we talk about this phrase that's on your PowerPoint, give the child wishes and fantasy, what I mean by that is kind of let the child daydream about what they would like to happen. So let's go back to that example about the not having the right green crayon. Oh, it's so frustrating when you have a certain idea of what color the grass should be and you only got this other yellowish green crayon that doesn't seem like the right color of what you think grass should be. I'm wondering what we should do about that. and help the child to process that for him or herself. So don't solve the problem for them. Now, I'm not talking about kids who lack a social skill that we need to build up. I'm talking about a child who has a social skill to problem solve, but that you would resist the impulse to do it for them. There are some mistakes that we do tend to make as parents, though. They oftentimes tend to be automatic, but they're things that really break our kids down. So a lot of times I will teach the parents how to recognize these hindrances to attention and empathy. One of them, and as I go through these, I want you to think about, as a child, how you'd feel when you go through this. One is blame and accusation. How can you do that? What's the matter with you? How many times do I have to repeat myself? You never, or you always. Let's think about that for a minute. How might a child feel? Probably defeated. Probably like a sense of shame. A sense of not just I did the wrong thing, but guess I just messed up. Guess you always notice all the things I do wrong. What about name calling? That was so stupid. That was awful. That was lazy. You're such a bad boy or girl. You're irresponsible. Or any other name calling. How might the child feel? Name calling is something that would get a child pretty defensive. Well, I'm not this or that. Especially if you're saying, let's take something like irresponsible. You're not responsible. You don't do your part. You don't follow through right. Then it would get into, but I did this. You know, what about you? The other day you didn't clean the dishes that were stacked up. Look at you. How can you talk? Oh, and I was responsible and I did such and such project for school. You didn't like the way it was done. I encourage people stick to the actual behaviors that are desired and talk about them as opposed to name calling. We want to stay away from issues of personhood that could increase defensiveness. Another hindrance to attention and empathy is threatening. Things like, if you don't shut up and listen, you'll get the whipping of your life. If you don't get ready, I'm leaving you here alone. The next time you take something that doesn't belong to me, you'll be spanked so much you never want to touch another person's stuff again. You think you're in trouble now? Just wait and see the punishment you'll get next time. You'll be grounded so long you'll feel like you've forgotten what it looks like inside this house. Or outside this house. So through, again, this sense of defeat, the child doesn't feel heard. It really doesn't teach them the skill. So let's take this first one, if you don't shut up and listen. It doesn't reinforce what listen means. I needed you to sit still here and make sure you understood what I was saying. I needed us to spend 5 minutes going through tonight's schedule before you go out with your friend so that we know what's happening. Otherwise, you won't be able to go out with someone else this weekend. Again, conditions, behaviors, focused on specific behaviors rather than general threats. What about commanding? Don't look at me like that. You do your homework now. Move it. You've wasted enough time. I told you to clean your room now. So this facilitates a power struggle. You know, sometimes parents don't realize, you know, why a child is in a power struggle. They'll come at it from the point of view of, oh, my child is giving me a hard time. They don't listen. But the fact of the matter is the way they're talking sets their child and them up for that. What about sarcasm? This is a really bad one. Things like how smart, forgetting your homework for the fifth time in 1 week, a new record. You expect to go out looking like that? You'll get noticed all right. What's tricky about sarcasm is kids are generally not at a developmental level that they truly understand sarcasm. And what happens is a lot of times they end up repeating sarcastic stuff maybe in school or end up bullying people or doing things where it's not regarded as a positive thing. And it's something that can set them up for a lot of failure. And finally, another hindrance to attention and empathy is prophecy. Telling your kid, if you keep this up, you're going to end up not having friends. You're going to end up on the street. You know, one of the things is we want our kids to come to their own conclusions of realizing that the unhealthy behaviors are not going to get them what they need. But telling them you're going to end up whatever, they don't believe that. They don't believe that we know anything about that. So instead, it's better to say, okay, help me understand how, you keep saying you want your parent to trust you. Help me understand how jumping out of the window at night and running to your friends is helping you win that trust. When I work with teens and I try to agree with them and say, you know what? That's a great thing. You want your parents to trust you? They're like, what? What? You want my parents to allow? I said, yeah, I'd love to see that happen. Let's see what we can do, what behaviors to help convince them that you're trustworthy. And then we look at concrete behaviors and how they're helping or not. The foundation that I think is most important, both for us to teach the parents and to teach the kids, is the I message. The first part is what we're feeling. I feel such and such. The situation, what our perception is about what's going on, and what behaviors we want to continue that are positive or we'd like to change. I'm going to show you some difference between what we call you message, which is blaming, hindering, those types of things that we just talked about, as opposed to an I message. A you message would be something like, you're so hurtful and mean to everyone. Well, it may be true that your child's pretty hurtful. But that, again, leads to a power struggle of, no, I'm not hurtful. Well, that person was a pain, it's just a fight back and forth, as opposed to the parents saying, I feel disrespected when family rules are not followed. If they're not respected, such and such, fill in the blank, with a consequence will happen. Another you message. You need to try harder. You could do so much better. I message. I'm very proud of your efforts when I see you putting time in your work, even when it means having to wait to watch your cartoons. You see, that one was turned around with a positive spin. And I encourage people to use the I message for the positive. Think back to a time when things were going better. What was happening? How could that behavior continue? Let's look at this last one. You're the nicest person I know. An I message would be, I am encouraged when you think of how your choices affect others. We've talked a lot about empathy, and that's one of the core variables that we talk about in establishing a therapeutic alliance. The literature that I've cited in this PowerPoint also adds a term called parenting empathy. And I want to make sure and define that for you, just to make that clear about what empathy may look like in a relationship with a parent and child. Parenting empathy is defined as awareness of a child's needs that entails the ability of the parent to understand the condition or state of mind of the child without actually experiencing the feelings of the child. So, for example, a parent may know what it's like to hope something would happen a certain way and it doesn't turn out that way. Maybe they don't understand why their child's that upset about the specific thing they're upset about why it didn't turn out that way, but they can relate to the emotion of things not going as they want. So that's where the empathy could come in. Empathy is one of the highest predictor of parenting outcomes. Those who can use empathy tend to have much more successful parenting. When we're talking about empathizing with the child and listening to the speaker, and this would also go towards teaching older kids how to listen to their parents, how to take their perspective. When I teach these skills, ideally, if I have access to the kids and the adults, I'm teaching both of them separately. Then we're having exercises and sessions together where they're able to practice it. So we're looking at listening to the speaker in four different areas. The experiences. What does that speaker believe is happening? And our point when we're listening is not to debate if it's accurate or not. Behaviors. What he or she is doing or not doing. The feelings or emotions. Now, these could be expressed or implied. You could hear someone say something and their behavior, their nonverbal, show something different. In thoughts and beliefs. So sometimes there may be some of these that may be more out in the open, and others we may need to dig a little deeper. Types of phrases we could use to try and understand where the person's coming from include these common empathic lead-ins. Things like, it sounds like, blah, blah, blah. I hear you saying, it looks like, if I hear you right, I'm sensing that you're thinking such and such. Is that correct? So again, really a checking in with the other person. Now, I've used some examples here that a child might say and see if, as the parent, how in the world would you respond to these? Again, keep in mind that empathy is not agreement. It's trying to feel with or understand why a person's feeling or perceiving things the way they are. So this child saying, you always bug me right after school when I'm with my friends. Don't you have a life besides bothering me? Why are you so eager to mess up my friendships? I feel so embarrassed because my friends' parents don't all call them right after school like you do. And when they do talk with them, it's not like a million questions like when you and I talk. So, as a parent, think back to those hindrances of empathy, hindrances to empathy we just talked about. It would be really easy to get defensive when you hear your child saying, don't you have a life besides bothering me? I actually had a case where a eighth grader said to her mom, you always have to call me because you have nothing better to do? Are you mad because you don't have friends or you didn't have friends like I do now? So it does take some training, it does take some working on. So as a parent, what emotions can we identify in this child as we're listening? Okay, they're frustrated. And they've even said they're embarrassed. They feel like time with their friends is a priority. They feel bothered. So I might say, gosh, you feel like I'm intruding on your time with your friends. Yeah, I do. I feel like, gosh, I can't even have that time. You have me in the evening at dinner time and later. Can't that just be enough? How much time do you need with me? I'm a teenager after all. Then to say what the perception of the situation is. You'd like more time with your friends. You feel like I'm interrupting a lot. Yeah. You feel like the way you and I deal with things is very different from what some other parents do. Yes. And the million questions, it's not working. So you'd like us to consider a different way of me finding out how the evening's going to go. Yeah. And when I worked with this child and the mom in actual real session, that was what we ended up coming up with. And I had the child also empathize with the parent. The parent said, you know, I got your brother to think about. I got your dad coming home from work. I got dinner. I got my stuff. And I have to figure out how are we going to fit this all in? How are we going to juggle it all? And if I don't accurately know what's going on, I don't know what the response is going to be. So then the child tried to paraphrase and make some empathy statements, trying to understand where the parent's coming from. Oh, so you're not upset because you don't have as many friends as I do. You're just worried that you won't be able to juggle all these things and figure them out in the evening if you don't know ahead of time. Yeah. So, ideally, we can teach each to the child, we can teach each to the parents. We're working, identifying, training these social skills to everybody in the system. Let's look at this next example. Let's face it, people can tell we're not from here. You tell me to try and be nice and fit in, but the fact is I don't fit in. We don't fit in with our country ways and Dad being a farmer and us wearing the stupid thrift store crap. Who are we fooling? We are not like them. I will never be like them. There's no fitting in here ever. So let me think of what this child's perception is. I don't fit in. I'm an outcast. I'm alone. I might say, you feel alone and like you're so different from everybody else. Well, darn right. You feel misunderstood by the people around us, that no one understands country life. You feel, and then I may even ask some questions. I'm wondering if you feel forced for us to move here and do the farming that we're doing when the other kids are doing different things. I'm wondering if you feel resentful because we don't have the money that some of the other kids have, and you're having to wear the, as you put it, stupid thrift store stuff. Let's look at another example here. How am I supposed to keep up with that? You want me to just concentrate more and pay attention? As if I'm not already doing that. When you don't understand it, paying attention more to what you don't understand does not make you suddenly understand it. Why is the problem always me? Like, I don't focus enough. I don't think I'll ever be as smart as you guys or as good at school as my brothers and sisters. So you better get that in your head now. That just won't be me, no matter how hard I try. So it sounds like this child has some assumptions that the parents don't think they're even trying. And those assumptions may or may not be true. As a parent, I might ask, so are you feeling that we think that you're not trying at all? So if I hear you right, you're saying you're just as frustrated about trying to pay attention and it not working out. I didn't know you were just as frustrated about that. I didn't know how hard that was for you. I'm not sure what you need to feel like you can pay attention more. That might be a new thing for the parent to hear. That's why this active listening is so important. Let's try this last example about empathizing with a child. Darn right I'm not happy. I had the life I wanted where we came from. Then we moved here. You guys got better jobs, but I lost everything that was important to me. Things will never be the same again. It was perfectly fine, and you ripped everything good, happy, and fun out from under me. It's all your fault. So again, you see how easy it would be for the parent to feel blamed, to feel defensive about that. But you say, you're really hurting because you feel like things were good and all you can see is it was good before and now it's bad. It's nothing like the way it was before. So with checking in with someone using what I call the communication games exercise, we're basically taking the three parts of the I message and making sure we understand where the other person's coming from. So first we're asking how they're feeling. Are you feeling such and such? Take a guess as to what word you think they might describe on their feelings. Oh, so you're feeling this because blank. oh, you would like such and such behavior to happen. So we've talked a lot about empathy, about the news reporter styling. Now, if we take things a step further, we're going to layer what I call praising on top of attending. We're going to describe what's going on. We're going to use descriptive words. We're going to help the child build a new picture of themselves, of their strengths, of what they're doing well, and help them store up special moments. So let's look at some examples where we would do that. In this first example, we're going to go back to the examples we just used too, by the way, so you can see how we build this up. John is fascinated by different types of toy cars. He has quite the collection of cars. One day during Mommy and John time, she notices that John's play with his cars. He races the fast sports cars. He puts others in a line and has some of them crash. He brings the emergency vehicles over and the road crew. When the phone rings, Mom stops to answer the phone, and Johnny throws his cars around the room. So how could I attend to the news reporter style and praise? Johnny, seems like you're getting ready to play with your cars. You got the sports cars all grouped together there, and you put some other cars in a different one. You seem to know a lot about what one type of car is versus another. Wow, I wouldn't know about the different types of cars. So you have all the fast sports cars in this pile, and seems like you got some others you've lined up. Oh, you even have a third group of cars, the emergency cars. I wonder how you learned so much about cars. That's really interesting. Let's look at the second example. Mary Ellen enjoys coloring. She especially loves to make pictures of flowers. In today's drawing, she chooses pink and purple shades for the petals of the flowers. When drawing the petals, though she cannot find the regular green, there is only a yellowish green or a deep forest green. She comments, "This isn't right. The flowers aren't supposed to look like this." She starts ripping her paper and crumbling it up because she thinks it did not turn out the way she planned with a certain green color. Mary Ellen, I really noticed that you seem to like coloring. I'm going to have to see what I can do to get you more coloring books, especially these flowers. Flowers seem to really be something for you. You're picking a lot of really pretty shades there, the pink and the purple, and it seems like you like to start with the top of the flower, the part that's called the petals. And you like to get all those really pretty flower colors in first. The grass might not be quite as interesting to do, so it seems like you really like to do the petals first. Finding just the right color can be really challenging, but you seem to take a lot of time to just want to do that and just do it right. Sometimes we seem to have to look extra carefully for that, or we might have to try something with a different kind of color. That's really something to think about. What about our next example of Lou? Lou likes watching his dad mow the lawn and work in the yard. He uses his toy lawn mower and plastic tools in the yard too. He walks in a line up and down the grass to mow evenly just like his dad, up and down, up and down. That is until the wheel gets stuck in a branch and some leaves. He can't push the plastic mower in a nice line like his dad anymore. This is stupid. It's messing everything up now, Lou screams. So if I was a dad, how could I affirm Lou? Son, I see how excited you are. Getting ready to start up your lawnmower just like me. We got them both in the starting line of our new row. We're getting ready to go up and down and back and forth. Ah, and we're going to keep walking. We're going to get each row back and forth. Man, look at those lines you're making. You're pretty good at those lines, just trying to do lines just like me. Those leaves can be tricky. Sometimes the lines aren't always the easiest thing, But you know, it seems like you keep trying and trying. Let's try another example here. You always bug me right after school when I'm with friends. Don't you have a life besides bothering me? Why are you so eager to mess up my friendships? I feel so embarrassed because my friends' parents don't all call them right after school like you do. And when they do talk with them, it's not like a million questions like when you and I talk. I'm realizing that your time with friends is really important to you, and you don't like things to be intruded upon with that. I think it's great that your friends have someone that they can count on, someone that they can depend on, and that you have set aside time for them. It's hard for me sometimes balancing knowing what we need to do as a family after school with that, but I like that you take very seriously your time with your friends, and that you're very protective of that. Let's look at the next example here. Let's face it, people can tell we're not from here. You tell me to try and be nice and fit in, but the fact is, I don't fit in. We don't fit in with our country ways and Dad being a farmer, and us wearing that stupid thrift store crap. Who are we fooling? We are not like them. I will never be like them. There's no fitting in here ever. I hear that you're tired of feeling alone and feeling like our family is pretty different from the other ones. Us being farmers and having very little money, that it's hard to buy the latest clothes, and you're feeling on the outside of things. You just wish I'd understand what it's like to be you, and you feel like I'm stuck in another generation and that I'm just never had to go through some of the stuff that you have to go through, and it's bothering you. You just wish I would understand. Let's try the last one. Darn right, I'm not happy. I had the life I wanted where we came from. Then we moved here. You guys got better jobs, but I lost everything that was important to me. Things will never be the same again. I was perfectly fine, and you ripped everything, good, happy, and fun, out from under me. It's all your fault. I might say, things seem normal. Things seem consistent, like you knew what you were going to count on. You had it to where you wanted it to be, and you were really happy. And then we shocked you and we forced you to do something different from what made you happy. Not only do you feel like because of it you're not happy, but you're feeling kind of miserable and you're not sure how to make the most of being stuck to move here. So you see how you can layer the attending and the praise. Again, we're not agreeing with the difficult behaviors. We're not agreeing with their point of view. The best thing we can do to promote empathy is also to make sure our nonverbals are showing empathy, that we're at a reasonable distance away, an arm's length away. We're relaxed. We're leaning towards the person. We're mirroring their facial expressions. So I just want to go back and summarize a little bit about what we talked about in this first section of today's seminar on the foundations of positive parenting. We talked about some of the common stresses and also some of the characteristics of healthy families. We talked about how those things don't just automatically happen. There's family of origin messages that we've grown up with that are multi-generational. There's beliefs that we have that the parents may need to have retaught, that the children may need to have retaught. There may be social skills and communication issues that need to be taught. Things like family meetings don't just happen naturally. That there needs to be time set aside for things like attending, like empathy, and like family meetings. We talked about the problems of too little and too much control, and the idea that sometimes something as simple as just being a news reporter and naming with full attention what the child is doing can be so meaningful to that child. Remarking about what they're doing, the changes, the differences, the things that are important to them, shows them that we actually care. We talked about things like how to use the iMessages and how to listen to various parts of what the person's trying to say, how to listen to the four parts of their experiences, their behaviors, their feelings and emotions, and their thoughts and beliefs. We talked about using the three parts of the iMessage to actually do something that I call the communication game, which is basically making sure that we understand the feeling as the other person experiences it, the situation as they see it, and what they'd ideally like to happen. We talked about how to put ourselves in someone else's shoes and how to do attending with appraising together and combine those two. So we'll be back shortly for this second part of today's seminar on foundations of positive parenting, and then we'll be actually diving into more of the issue of how to handle inappropriate behavior, because that's usually what the parents or the family counseling is about. But I wanted to highlight in this first part the importance of making sure there's certain foundational things done first.